In my experience, there are very few patients who have the difficult to treat label that if you really sit down and go back from the beginning of when their headache started, what the patterns were like, what the influences were, what about psychiatric comorbidities, what about medical comorbidities, and really walk through all that and listen to what they have to say and ask them questions that tell the story of what their pattern of migraine is like. I really believe that most of the time, if not all the time, one can come up with strategies. They may not make someone completely headache-free, but they can restore function and they can restore quality of life.
People living with migraine will tell you how important it is to reduce its impact on their lives. And some people do that successfully with medications. But wading through the options we've historically had for preventive migraine therapies can be confusing. And we're fortunate to be in a time of great research and development in migraine that has brought many new medications. But how do we know which might be worth trying? Here to help us break down the options in migraine prevention is Dr. Jan Lewis Brandis. Dr. Brandis, welcome to the Migraine World Summit.
I'm thrilled to be here.
When is preventive therapy for migraine recommended?
Well, there are guidelines about when it's recommended in terms of, they're primarily directed against frequency and severity. And tying into severity, of course, would be disability. So the disabling migraine attack, the migraine attack which interferes with one's ability to do what they want to do or need to do at any point in time. So the predominant focus is on frequency of headache. The higher the frequency, the more one needs or is likely to need or have preventive therapy. And then the other component which therapy, preventive therapy can be directed at is severity. So capturing both frequency and severity are very important. They're not the only reasons. If someone doesn't have a good response to acute therapy or the therapy that they take at the start of a migraine attack, if they can't take it, let's say it's someone who has coronary artery disease and they can't take a triptan, now we have more acute options. But if they couldn't, that would be someone who really would particularly be need to be offered prevention. Or someone who has a migraine subtype, like migraine with brainstem aura or migraine with prolonged aura. We would tend to think of individuals who have those patterns of migraine as being important. They would be, it would be an important feature to offer them prevention. So I'd say the focus is predominantly on reducing frequency and reducing severity. And along with that, of course, one is usually, if you're reducing frequency, you would be reducing the number of days or the number of acute medications that someone would take. So you not only avoid the side effects from those acute medicines, but you also drop the risk for migraine, for medication overuse headache, which is important for any number of reasons. We know that if patients are in medication overuse, at least the older oral preventives didn't seem to work as well. I think one of the really fantastically interesting things about the new CGRP monoclonal antibodies is that for many of those trials, patients who had medication overuse were included. So we have now information about what happens when you go on a preventive strategy and then your number of acute migraine medication days drops. The conventional strategy is prevention for reducing frequency and severity. And along with that, if as your frequency goes up, you don't have to have as much disability. Those are guidelines. But I think, you know, for me, if I have a patient, we know migraine, of course, is a 4 to 72 hour event in adults. So if you have, if someone is having 3 days of migraine, of a migraine attack, and that happens to them twice a month, that's only 2 attacks if you count attacks, but that is 6 days and that's a week. So I think guidelines are important, and I think the guidelines really are quite useful when we look at trying to get medications and encourage people to go on prevention.
I'd love to come back to the CGRP monoclonal antibodies in a moment. You mentioned a couple of things that I'd love to ask you about. First of all, You mentioned medication overuse headache, or sometimes now called medication adaptation headache too. Why is frequent use of certain medications even a problem?
Well, one of the things that happens, of course, with it is that it pushes the headache to a higher frequency. So that if you use an acute medication, or if you use some acute medications more than 2 or 3 days a week, one increases his or her risk for having a more frequent pattern of headache. So you push it over that sort of 15-day line in the sand. The other thing, of course, is that when you're using an acute medication, let's say it's a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, those are associated with with gastritis. They can be associated with GI bleeding. They increase risk for renal failure. And we know their association in terms of heart disease. So those medicines, while they are really important and are incredibly useful for so many individuals in terms of pain control for a number of conditions, the frequency of use is really important because the potential for side effects is really there. I mean, they can increase hypertension or increase the risk for high blood pressure if one is overusing them. Acetaminophen or paracetamol, that can be predominantly associated with medication overuse. And again, if in high enough doses for a long enough period of time with liver failure or hepatic failure. So there are different components. We know that triptans, you know, have been around for 25 years. But we can't use them, or we should not use them, in patients who have vascular disease, whether it's coronary or cerebrovascular or peripheral vascular disease. So that, if people are using them too often, that may be increasing their risk for complications from an ischemic or a narrow vessel disorder. So there are many different things that I think are really part of that. So one of the components is that it increases the risk for more frequent headache. And with the oral agents in particular, it means with the oral preventive agents, drugs like topiramate, valproate, valproic acid, amitriptyline, the beta blockers that are often used for migraine, even sometimes verapamil or a drug like candesartan. If one uses it too often, the preventive medications will not have, and that's been shown in any number of clinical studies, they will not have the same efficacy. So they don't have the same benefit.
Interesting. So I'm hearing that overuse or too frequent use of acute medications can pose a few risks. Number one, it can actually exacerbate migraine, even if it helps in the moment, can lead to increased frequency of attacks. Number two, that there can be other side effects outside of migraine that those medications could potentially lead to. You mentioned NSAIDs and GI effects. And third, that increased use or too frequent use of acute medications could actually decrease the efficacy of your preventive medication itself.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's true. And I think there's been some nice work showing that if you have an ineffective acute treatment, one that does not get you pain-free within, say, 2 hours, and that does not keep you pain-free, that you tolerate, if you don't have that sort of therapy, that kind of acute therapy, you're at risk for chronification of migraine, for moving from episodic to chronic migraine. And I think it's really important. When I trained, they used to call medication overuse, now again, it's the name is adapting again, but they used to refer to it as rebound headache. And it was sort of this, shameful kind of thing. I always tell patients that we are going to put you on preventive therapy and two things may happen. One is that we may reduce the frequency of your attacks, and that may come first. The other thing is we may reduce the severity of your attacks and that your acute medication will work better. If you're lucky, if you're fortunate, you may get both at the same time, but we'll look at either one. And I think that brings us back to part of the issue related to prevention, which is that we have to count more than just the number of days. We have to look at what's the overall what's the overall response to a preventive medication? And we often don't do that. And I think that's where diaries can be so important, because one of the things that I've seen with prevention through the years is that as people get better, it's such a fascinating phenomenon. As individuals with migraine get better when they go on preventive strategies and they begin to really get involved in the behavioral aspects and being careful and treating early for with an acute medication, and they're sort of putting their preventive strategies into place, as they get better when they have an attack, it feels like they're going backwards. So that often if you have someone who actually may have a lower number of migraine attacks, but when they break through, it just feels like the world is black again, because they then remember what it was like to have them more frequently and to be more severe.
What are the major classes of medications in migraine prevention?
Well, the ones that have historically been used are the oral migraine preventives, and probably the ones that are FDA approved, or in the United States, the FDA, Federal Drug Administration, those are beta blockers. And then two drugs that were originally studied and, of course, were approved for epilepsy or seizure disorders. So valproate, valproic acid, and topiramate. So what we really have had until recently are drugs that have been, in essence, sort of repurposed. And they were found fortuitously and because of really careful patient explanation to clinicians and clinicians paying attention to notice that, particularly in the case of the beta blockers, that these drugs really benefited not only your tachycardia or your post-MI success, but they also dropped migraine. So those beta blockers, the anti-epileptic drugs, of which we have two, though many are used, those are the two that have FDA approval. Calcium channel blockers, angiotensin receptor blocker, the angiotensin receptor blocker candesartan has some, I think, quite good evidence. And then we have the older drugs, the old tricyclic antidepressants, amitriptyline, which is one that for many patients and in a sort of, you know, people kind of put their hands up when you say that. But for many individuals, amitriptyline can be a very effective, again, in somebody who has a lower frequency, that may be a very good choice. It's a serotonin, it's a 5-HT2 receptor antagonist, so it can be a good choice in someone who maybe has chronic back pain or who has migraine, who has difficulty sleeping. So there are all kinds of medications. A lot of them have this problematic association because of side effects. And again, many of them were started at doses that were too high for an individual patient, or maybe they weren't done in combination. So those would be among the bigger groups in terms of prevention. So calcium channel blockers, a lot of the antihypertensive drugs, so beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, angiotensin receptor blockers, the anticonvulsants, those would be among the major drugs that have FDA approval. And then the other one that was approved, I think it was in 2010, if I don't think I'm off a year then, was on a botulinum toxin, which was approved as and is licensed as Botox, which was the first preventive for chronic migraine. So it was approved by the FDA for chronic migraine or for individuals who have more than 15 days. So those are kind of the big categories. And then, of course, several years ago, after many years of clinical trials and decades before that of research into the function or the role of calcitonin-gene-related peptide in migraine and its potential for manipulation in therapy, we have the calcitonin gene-related peptide monoclonal antibodies that tie up that inflammatory peptide.
And are you seeing efficacy with the CGRP monoclonal antibodies in patients who perhaps have not responded to any prior therapies?
Yes, and that's one of the very reassuring components of being able to offer it. We do see some patients that have not responded to other therapies. The other thing we see is that patients who perhaps have responded to therapies but have not gotten where they want to be or where we want them to be in terms of numbers. And for some patients, they will go to zero. We saw that in the trials. They'll have a month where they have no migraine. And for others, it will be that they may be a higher frequency patient. They may have, or a person who has a higher frequency, and they may have their CGRP monoclonal antibody added on, and then they drop into a lower number. The other thing that it allows one to do, I'm a firm believer in unless somebody's having trouble in terms of side effects or a drug is not working, in adding the CGRP monoclonal antibody, add it, keep the diary carefully, have the discussion, and then if the numbers begin to really fall, then you can begin to sort of ease down that oral preventive. I think what we don't ever want to do is to just put one on and take one off. I think it really, for many individuals, it's like treating any other complex medical condition. It often takes polytherapy. And I think, 25 years ago when I was in training, it was just anathema. No one wanted to talk about polytherapy. But if one thinks about it, we don't completely understand the pathophysiology of migraine. We know that, there are drugs that work in the periphery seem to have an incredibly beneficial effect on this disorder that we think of as being central. So there are all kinds of things. And why don't the CGRP monoclonal antibodies work for everyone? Well, it must mean that that's not the predominant mechanism for some patients. And why does something like topiramate, if someone can tolerate that strategy, why does it work for heterogeneous populations of migraine? Probably because it has 21 or 22 different mechanisms at play.
So it sounds like polytherapy and working with a provider who is well-versed in exploring it can be very important in these situations.
I think so.
Another viewer, Kim, who takes a CGRP monoclonal antibody for prevention and then another medication for management acutely of migraine attacks, finds relief. But she mentioned that she gets a new headache then the next day every time and wonders what she should do.
Well, the fact that she's having to take an acute medication and then the headache's back the next day and she's likely having to repeat dose, that raises concern about medication overuse headache. And it also raises concern that her preventive medication is really not doing everything that she needs it to do. And I think one of the things that we're beginning to see is that in individuals where they really just don't respond, where they don't appear to have a measurable response to preventive therapy, that maybe we need to rethink diagnosis. Maybe some of these individuals have a chronic low pressure headache that simply the features of which have sort of morphed into this chronic daily headache, and we need to think about it. That can sometimes, I think, masquerade as migraine. It can sound and feel like migraine, and there's no reason why someone can't have migraine in that too.
Laura, who lives with chronic migraine and generally has some degree of headache in between every attack, wrote in, and I'd like to read what she says, which is, I truly only have about 1 to 2 pain-free days each month, and sometimes not even that. It seems I've tried just about everything out there, PT, diet, multiple triptans, multiple CGRP meds, preventive and acute, Botox, blood pressure meds, anti-epileptics, antidepressants, NSAIDs, some of these in combination with little to no improvement. What should be the next step?
Well, I think, again, it's revisiting the diagnosis. Is if you go back to the beginning, someone taught me a long time ago to always ask, when did you first have headache? What was your headache like in childhood? If you had it in childhood, what do you first remember about headache? So to see, to really look at an overall pattern, because I think that may give one, give a physician or a clinician opportunities to think about how that migraine behaves if one thinks it's migraine. I think the other thing is, she doesn't mention specific hormonal therapies. And I know you have multiple interviews and discussions about this. during the summit, but I think that's something that's very under-recognized as being an important part of a preventive regimen, so that you can have the best setup for, you can have the best combination of preventive therapies, but if one ignores the influence of estrogen fluctuation or a high estrogen state or a low estrogen state on, and that impact on an individual with migraine, I think it's very, I think sometimes when people get labeled as being difficult to treat and they go to see someone and, you know, they've got the list of 23 drugs that they've been tried on and they've tried PT and all the things that she lists, I think they sometimes get the reputation or the impression is that they're really difficult to treat and that nothing's going to help them. And, you know, it's that you're my last hope. And a lot of, you know, I think sometimes physicians go, you know, this, you know, there's really not much else I can do for you. And I think that's really not correct, because I think in my experience, there are very few patients who have the difficult to treat label, that if you really sit down and go back from the beginning of when their headaches started, what the patterns were like, what the influences were, what about psychiatric comorbidities, what about medical comorbidities, and really walk through all that and listen to what they have to say and ask them questions that tell the story of what their pattern of migraine is like, I really believe that most of the time, if not all the time, one can come up with strategies. They may not make someone completely headache free, but they can restore function and they can restore quality of life.
Well, I think that's very hopeful to hear. I have heard from many the devastation that they've felt when they've heard those words, there's nothing I can do for you. So it's nice to hear such a different perspective, I know, for many on that. Speaking of hope, is there anything in the pipeline in migraine prevention that you're particularly excited about?
Yes, there are some monoclonal antibodies being studied that are directed toward one of the compounds that's one of the peptides that's ahead of CGRP. So it's a pituitary adenylate cyclase peptide. And there are, there's been one trial that was not as positive as one hoped, again, but there are others at play. So I think that we will increasingly see, I think that's been the real beauty of the research and the work on cloning the CGRP receptor and then developing antibodies toward either the peptide or the receptor. I think the other thing is that not necessarily new compounds, but I think if you look at the IV form of eptinezumab, the CGRP monoclonal antibody, I think that drug, there's some new data that suggests this role that moves into both acute and preventive. It's interesting to think about where we'll be in 10 years with this. And will it be one answer for everyone? Probably not. We know migraine's a very heterogeneous disorder, but, and the hormonal influences are really important. I hope we'll have more research in terms of the hormonal influences on migraine. I think that's where we lack a lot of information. And I think the other thing is that we need to really have more advocacy for women in clinical trials, in these large preventive trials, to look at hormonal factors as they go through those trials. We need to know what happens if someone's on a preventive medication during their menstrual cycle, during their placebo week. And I think the other thing in terms of advocacy, we don't have a great deal of information on women other than Caucasian women. So we need to really also have advocacy for women of color, men as well. We need to really try to have we really need to attract more diverse migraine patients, because that's how we not only help people, but we gain more information about how the disorder migraine or the disease migraine really impacts different populations of patients. And so I think those are some things that for me, from the standpoint of being a clinical researcher, those are really important to me. I think those are because we still in this country, again, something I looked at the other day, only about 13% of patients, you know, really get offered preventive therapy. Now, obviously that number is different if you go to a headache clinic, but if you look at the number of headache specialists in the United States, it's, I think now under 1,000. I mean, it's a preposterous concept to think that headache specialists can take care of everyone with migraine. So that's why I think that your summit really raises awareness, raises issues related to advocacy, and helps arm patients with information that they need to take to maybe it's their primary care doctor. There's no reason why we can't really sort of train an army of people to help with migraine prevention. And the earlier in a lifetime that we do it, I think most of us would agree, though they're not long-term trials for that. They're not decade after decade trials. But in general, if someone's migraine is controlled earlier, they're much less likely to spiral into chronic migraine and into migraine that is very difficult to control. And then sort of the other area, I think in terms of prevention, that's something I have been interested in. I had about 600 patients in this particular study. It was looking at adverse child experiences. And so the impact of that having had adverse childhood experiences on the chronification of migraine is really important, because we know that there can be structural and permanent changes in brain from both an endocrinologic and a structural change in brain in individuals who have had adverse childhood experiences. And what does that mean when someone comes into treatment when they're 42? And many times that's not been asked about. So I think that that is something that is of real interest to me. I will say that as I looked at the patients I had in that trial when we did it, it was totally anonymous, and they were asked to complete information about childhood, about their experiences in childhood. What we heard over and over for many patients who had very, very severe chronic migraine and often coexisting depression or anxiety, no one had ever asked that before.
Are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with the audience, Dr. Brandis?
Well, I would say it sounds really, in today's world, sort of, I guess, idealistic, but I would say never give up hope. Keep reading, looking at credible sources. You know, the summit provides a wealth of really wonderful, accurate, informative information. And organizations like the National Headache Foundation, the Migraine Trust, there are many different patient organizations and advocacy organizations where one can get information. And then just stay with it. If someone says, I can't help you, find someone who can, because there are an increasing number, I think, of individuals who are really committed to migraine treatment and who want individuals to really have the kind of treatment that they need and deserve. So never give up. And then I will close with this. If I got this, I'm on sabbatical right now. So I got this very sweet note from a patient, and she said, she's been my patient for 20 years. She says, the CGRP antagonist drugs are amazing. And then she mentions the one that she's on. The second one I tried, and again, she's also on oral preventives. She said, the second one I tried has worked perfectly for me. I now have zero migraines. This is the sentence I want. It's like I feel I'm living someone else's life. And then she goes on to say lovely things about our time together.
And that she certainly deserves to soon feel like that other life is her very own.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. You have covered so much important information around migraine prevention, and we will have so many people who can take so much and learn so much from this. So thank you so much, Dr. Brandis, for joining us today on the Migraine World Summit.